His own desires had very little to do with what came from himself, because what he put out, at least in part, already had been out. His way to make it new was make it again, and making it again was enough for him, and certainly, personally speaking, almost him. And second passage with the second slide. Quote, "They were always impressed by the photographs of Jackson Pollock, but didn't particularly think much about his paintings, since painting was something they associated with a way to put things together that seemed to them pretty much taken care of. They hung the photographs of Pollock right next to those new personality posters they just bought. These posters had just come out. They were black and white blow-ups, at least 30 by 40 inches. And picking one out felt like doing something any new artist should do. The photographs of Pollock were what they thought Pollock was about. And this kind of take wasn't as much a position as an attitude, a feeling that an abstract expressionist, a TV star, a Hollywood celebrity, a president of a country, a baseball great, could easily mix and associate together, and what measurements or speculations they used to separate their value could now be done away with. I mean, it seemed to them that Pollock's photographs looked pretty good next to Steve McQueen's, next to JFK's, next to Vince Edwards, next to Jimmy Pearsall's, and so on." Close quote. What Prince does is one version of a postmodernist practice that has come to be called appropriation. Now, appropriation in intelligent hands like those of Prince is certainly postmodernist, but is not the sine qua non of postmodernism. I say this because in certain places, appropriation has gained a bit of notoriety, thanks largely to works like Sherry Levine's Torso of Neil, where the artist simply made a copy print of a great and hallowed Edward Weston image and appropriated it as her own. It seems important to stress that appropriation as a tactic is not designed per se to tweak the noses of the Weston heirs, to épater la bourgeoisie, or to test the limits of the First Amendment. It is rather a direct, if somewhat crude, assertion of the finiteness of the visual universe. Those artists using others' images believe, like Prince, that it is dishonest to pretend that untapped visual resources are still out there in the woods, waiting to be found by artists who can then claim to be original. Not only is imagery now overdetermined, that is, the world already has been glutted with pictures taken in the woods, but even if this weren't the case, no one comes into the woods free of culture. In fact, we enter the woods as prisoners of our preconceived image of the woods, and what we bring back on film merely confirms our preconceptions. Another artist to emphasize the unmasking aspect of postmodernist practice is Louise Lawler. While perhaps less well known than Sherry Levine, she examines the structures and contents in which images are seen, contexts in which images are seen, with great resourcefulness. What makes her work unlike Levine's is that it is possible to read at least some of its message from the image itself, whereas Levine's tabula rasa appropriations depend on, one, their captions, and two, a theoretical explanation that one must find elsewhere. Lawler's pictures fall into several groups: photographs of arrangements of pictures made by others. This is an arrangement of things at the Metropolitan Museum. Photographs of arrangements of pictures arranged by the artist herself. And installations of arrangements of pictures. Why the emphasis on arrangement? Because for Lawler, the meaning of images is always a matter of their context, especially their relations with other images. One often gets the feeling in looking at her work of trying to decode a rebus. The choice, sequence, and positions of the pictures she shows us imply a rudimentary grammar or syntax. Using pictures by others, Jenny Holzer, Elliot Porter, Sherry Levine's notorious Torso of Neil, she urges us to consider the reverberations between them. James Welling's pictures might be called appropriation by inference. This is called Twilight of the Gods. That is, instead of representing someone else's image, they present the archetype of a certain kind of image. Unlike Prince and Lawler, he molds raw material to create his pictures, but the raw material he uses is likely to be as mundane as crumpled aluminum foil, jello, or soap flakes spilled on a velvet drape. These pictures look like pictures we have seen, abstractionist photographs from the equivalent school of modernism, perhaps, with their aspirations to embody some essence of human emotion. But in Welling's work, the promise of emotional expressionism is always unfulfilled. Welling's pictures present a state of contradiction. In expressive terms, they seem to be about something specific, yet they're about everything and nothing. In the artist's eyes, they embody tensions between seeing and blindness. That is, they offer the viewer the promise of insight, but at the same time reveal nothing but the inconsequence of the materials with which they were made. They're in one sense landscapes, in another abstractions. In still another sense, they're dramatizations of the postmodernist condition of representation. The kind of postmodernist art I've been showing you is on the whole not responsive to any photographic canon. It takes up photography because photography is an explicitly reproducible medium, because it is the common coin of cultural interchange, and because it avoids the aura of authorship that post-structuralist thought calls into question, or at least it avoids it to a greater extent than does painting or sculpture. Photography is, for these artists, the medium of choice. It is not necessarily their aim to be photographers, or for most of them to be allied with the traditions of art photography. Indeed, some of them remain quite happily ignorant of the photographic tradition. This is because they are coming from another tradition, one rooted theoretically in American art criticism, and one rooted practically in conceptual art practice, which most of them learned in art schools. But at least as large an influence on these artists is the experience of present-day life itself, as perceived through the mediation of popular culture, TV, films, advertising, corporate logoism, PR, People Magazine, in short, the entire industry of mass media image making. And it is not only in New York or Los Angeles that one finds photographs like these. Indeed, the practice of photography as a whole seems increasingly to be concerned with issues of representation, fabrication, melodrama, and the blank parody that is pastiche. Let me quickly show you a selection of work from the quote-unquote mainstream of contemporary art photography, work that seems not unrelated to what I've just shown you. Consider, for example, William Wegman's deadpan photographs of his dog, the late Man Ray, or Sandy Skoglund's tableau of childhood fears and adult dreams. Or Ellen Brooks's miniaturized sexual encounters. Consider Ann Turin's series on early education, Lessons and Notes. Or Nick Nicosia's domestic dramas. Or Phil Galgiani's carpentry and hat workshop. Or James Kazebeer's foam core suburbs. Or think of Robert Cummings' photographs, which plumb the underlying structure of the world and find it on the brink of decay. These pictures, too, evidence the postmodernist attitude and suggest how widespread it has become. You're all awake. By now, I hope I've been able to demonstrate that postmodernism not only means something different to architects and dancers and painters, it also means different things depending on which architect or dancer or painter you're listening to. And I hope that I have explained some of the critical issues of postmodernism as they have made themselves manifest in the art world, and shown how these issues are embodied in photographs that we call postmodernist. So now it is time for the eternal question, what about Robert Heineken, Robert Rauschenberg, pop art et al.? That is to say, didn't photography in the art world long ago become involved with pastiche, appropriation, questions of mass media representation, and so on? This happens to be a slide of a rephotographed magazine piece done by Robert Heineken in 1966, when Richard Prince was still in knickers. The only response I can give to this question is, yes, they did, but it's not quite the same. To clarify what I mean by that, I need to digress briefly once again to establish the existence of what we might call photography's inherent strain of postmodernism. To do this, of course, I have to define what I mean by photography's modernism. Once again, we have the perfect slide. Modernism in photography is a 20th century aesthetic which subscribes to the concept of the photographic and bases its critical judgments about what constitutes a good photograph accordingly. Under modernism, as it developed over the course of this century, photography was held to be unique, with capabilities of description and a capacity for verisimilitude beyond those of painting, sculpture, printmaking, or any other medium. What modernism in the visual arts valued, I'm speaking in the past tense partly as a matter of convenience to separate modernism from postmodernism and partly to suggest its current vestigial status, what modernism in the arts valued was the notion that painting should be about painting, sculpture about sculpture, photography about photography. If photography were merely a description of what the pyramids along the Nile looked like, or of the dissipated visage of Charles Baudelaire, then it could hardly be said to be a form of art. Modernism required that photography cultivate the photographic, indeed, that it invent the photographic, so that its legitimacy would not be questioned. In a nutshell, two strands, Alfred Stieglitz's American Purism, seen in this 1935 Stieglitz picture of Georgia O'Keeffe's hand, and Laszlo Moholy-Nagy's European experimental formalism, conspired to cultivate the photographic, and together they wove the shape of modernism in American photography, as we now know it. As it developed and coalesced over the course of this century, this heritage represented photography's claim to be a modern art. I promised Stan I would mention Minor White, and Minor White represents the apotheosis of the Stieglitzian belief in the equivalent, which is based on another belief that form encapsulates expression. Ironically, however, just at the moment when this claim was coming to be more fully recognized by the art world, and I refer to the building of a photographic marketplace in the 1970s, the ground was being shifted underneath its feet. Suddenly, it seemed, artists without any allegiance to this tradition were using photographs and, even worse, gaining a great deal more attention than traditional photographers. People who hardly seemed to be serious about photography as a medium, this is David Hockney, Rauschenberg, Ed Ruscha, Lucas Samaras, Bill Wegman, David Haxton, Robert Cumming, Byrne, and Hilla Becker, were incorporating it into their work or using it plain. Meanwhile, conceptual artists were using photographs together with texts to document ephemeral or merely imagined activities. Photographicness was no longer an issue as formalism's domain in the art world collapsed. The stage was set for what would come next, and what came next we now call postmodernism. At the same time, however, it is possible to see the seeds of postmodernism within the history of American modernist photography. Here I get to my most problematic aspects. Beginning, I would argue, with Walker Evans. Now, however much we admire Evans as a documentarian, as the photographer of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, as a straight photographer of considerable formal intelligence and resourcefulness, one cannot help but notice in studying his work of the 1930s how frequently billboards, posters, road signs, and even other photographs are found in his pictures. It is possible to believe, as some have argued, that these images within Evans's images are self-conscious and self-referential, that they are there to double us back and bring us into awareness of the act of photographing and the two-dimensional cropped from a larger context condition of the photograph as a picture. But they are also there as signs. They are, of course, signs in the literal sense, but they are also signs of the growing dominion of acculturated imagery. In other words, Evans shows us that even in the South, which, sad to say, in the mind of much of the country still evokes notions of the primitive, even in the primitive South, images of Hollywood glamour and consumer pleasures, images designed to create desire, were omnipresent. The knee-high sign Evans pictured was, in its time, as much a universal sign as the golden arches of Hamburger Land are today. Evans's attention to signs and to photography as a sign-making or semiotic medium goes beyond the literal. As we can see in the images he included in American Photographs and in their sequencing, Evans was attempting to create a text with his photographs. He in fact created a successful and evocative nexus of signs, a symbology of things American. Read the way one reads a novel, with each page building on those that came before, this symbology describes American experience as no other photographer had yet been able to do. And the experience it describes is one in which imagery plays a role that can only be described as political. We can see the same kind of attempt to create a symbolic statement of American life in Robert Frank's book, The Americans. Frank used the automobile and the road as metonymic metaphors of the American cultural condition, which he envisioned every bit as pessimistically as today's postmodernists. While not so image-conscious as Evans, he did conceive of imagery as a text, as a sign system capable of signification. This obviously is the end of the road. The inheritors of Frank's and Evans's legacy adopted both their faith in the photograph as a social sign and their skeptical view of American culture. Lee Friedlander's work, for example, despite having somehow earned a reputation as formalist, largely consists of a critique of our conditioned ways of seeing. In his picture, Mount Rushmore, we see a kind of proto-postmodernist sensibility at work. This is 1969. It is an amazingly compact commentary on the act of seeing in the late 20th century. The natural sight, spelled S-I-T-E, has become acculturated sight, spelled S-I-G-H-T. Man has carved the mountain in his own image. The tourists look at it through the intervention of lenses, like the photographer himself. The scene appears only as a reflection, mirroring or doubling the condition of photographic appearances, and it is framed, cropped by the windows, just like a photograph. Despite the fact that Friedlander took this picture in 1969, well before anyone thought to connect photography and postmodernism, I would argue that it is more than a modernist explication of photographic self-referentiality. I believe it also functions critically in a postmodernist sense, inasmuch as it causes us to question the public monument as public image, and to reconsider our conventionalized ways of looking at it. It is, in short, an image about received images. Take this Linda Connor picture from 1970. By intervening in a reproduction of Botticelli's Venus with shells of her own, she interrupts its almost cliched status as an icon of art history, an operation that is essentially postmodernist. Or consider John Fall's 1977 image, Moonrise Over Pipan, from the series Altered Landscapes. Here, Fall uses his irrepressible humor to mask a much more serious intention, which is to call attention to our absence of innocence as regards the landscape. By intervening in the land with his partly conceptual, partly madcap bag of tricks, and by referencing us not to the scene itself, but to another photograph, namely Ansel Adams's Moonrise over Hernandez, Fall supplies evidence of the postmodern condition. That is to say, it seems impossible to claim in this day and age that one can have a direct, unmediated experience of the world. All we see is seen through the kaleidoscope of all that we have seen before. So in answer to the Heineken question, what I want to say is that the photographic tradition seems to incorporate the sensibility of postmodernism within its late or high modernist practice. This seems true not only of photography, but of the painting and sculpture tradition as well, where, for example, one can see Rauschenberg's work of the 50s and 60s as proto-postmodern, or even parts of the pop art phenomenon of the 60s, like Andy Warhol's silkscreen paintings based on photographs. If anyone wants to get a better idea of this in the next few months, you can go to the Whitney Museum and see the Blam Show. Rauschenberg, Johns, Warhol, Lichtenstein, and others break with abstract expressionism. They also brought into play the photographic image as raw material and the idea of pastiche as artistic practice. It seems unreasonable to claim, then, that postmodernism in art necessarily represents a clean break with modernism. That, as Douglas Crimp has written, quote, postmodernism can only be understood as a specific breach with modernism, with those institutions which are the preconditions for and which shape the discourse of modernism, close quote. And what, in Crimp's eyes, are the institutions that have shaped modernism? He names three: the museum, art history, and, curiously enough, photography. Why photography? Crimp says, quote, because modernism depends upon its presence and upon its absence. And so we arrive, with this picture by Barbara Kruger, at another problem of postmodernism, which is that most people view it with some hostility, tinged in most cases with considerable defensiveness. Having found myself on the receiving end of this reaction more than once, being in some sense a messenger bearing bad news, I have a feeling that the problem for most people with the idea of postmodernism is the premise that it represents a rupture with the past, with the traditions of art that most of us grew up with and love. But as I have tried to show, it is only through considerable intellectual contortions that one can postulate so clean a break. One has to fence in modernism so tightly, be so restrictive about its practice, that the effort hardly seems worthwhile. So perhaps, contra Crimp, we can find a way to conceive of postmodernism in a way that acknowledges its evolution from modernism. One of the ways we might do this is by shifting the grounds on which we define postmodernism from questions of style or intention to grounds that involve one's way of conceiving of the world. Yet here lies an even deeper source of hostility to postmodernism, one rooted in beliefs that many of us hold near and dear. Postmodernist art accepts the world as an endless hall of mirrors, as a place where all we are is images, as in Cindy Sherman's world, and where all we know are images, as in Richard Prince's universe. There is no place in the postmodern world for a belief in genuine experience, in the sanctity of the individual artist, in genius or originality. What postmodern art finally tells us is that things have been used up, that we're at the end of the line, that we're all prisoners of what we see. Postmodern art accepts this condition without remorse, without regret, without qualms. What we make of this depends on what we feel about these attitudes and beliefs, but it seems to me quite fruitless to try to deny their existence. Thank you.